Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am a TV critic for Rolling Stone, where I review Game of Thrones, The New York Observer, Wired, and other places. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled, the A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at boiledleather.com that hosts this lovely podcast. And I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones for the Subtext iPad app with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros and The World of Ice and Fire, and series editor Anne Grohl. And joining me, as always, is my illustrious co-host.
Stefan Sasse, I am a contributor of essays and recently the reviews for Season 5 of Game of Thrones for the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com, and now we are going to talk finally for, I don't know how long it has been, but now we are back together again, braving the time zones and real life to take on two topics, which are the recently released Elaine chapter and the also recently released first two episodes of season 5 of the Game of Thrones. So, Sean, what did you think about the Elaine chapter?
You know, there's not a whole lot to think about the Elaine chapter. I suppose that's my basic takeaway from it. She's learning more of the ways of being in court, I guess, for want of a better phrase. I'm sure there is a better phrase, I just don't know what it is. But generally with Sansa, we haven't really been able to see her sort of get up and mix and mingle and be treated like a desirable figure within these aristocratic circles that she moves in. Obviously, she knew a lot about how to navigate the dangerous ways of the ruling class in King's Landing, but she mostly did so from the perspective of a hostage, literally, a prisoner, you know, because of her her father's alleged treason. She, you know, after that happened, she was always kind of looked upon askance. You know, she was married to a guy who was treated like a joke, and here, even though she's a bastard, she's sort of able to come into her own a little bit. She's an interesting marriage prospect. She is very, very close with the Lord of the Vale. And what is Peter, like the Lord Regent of the Vale? Or the
Lord Protector.
Lord Protector, okay. And is he Warden? Is he Warden of the East?
No, that's Jaime Lannister.
Oh, right, Jaime's both, right, okay. But, you know, anyway, she's mixing and mingling with big shots, and she's apparently very pretty. So you get to kind of see how she would handle things with when given a little bit more power, a little bit more agency. And that's cool, but, you know, is there much to say beyond that? I'm not sure. I'm never the best person to follow the nuances of what will happen if so-and-so marries so-and-so and, you know, and this other person dies and this other guy gets knighted.
No,
you know, maybe there's stuff like that in there, but that I didn't pick up on. But what do you think?
That's also not down my alley, but I want to happily point out every listener to Stephen Atwell, who is the correct to go to for these kind of matters.
Yes.
And he also wrote about it on his own Tumblr, so you might want to check that out. I think what you could see is a little bit of the things to come, because you get this little glimpse into strategy, what's going on in the Vale, what is Littlefinger up to, and what is happening elsewhere, and also some small little details. One thing is this thing about the tapestries. You were asked this question on your Tumblr, I had seen, but you didn't know what to make of the tapestry thing. Have you found out by now? Or
no, I haven't. It rang a bell after I responded to that ask. I was like, wait a minute, I've heard about these damn tapestries before. But what's
okay, so let me play your wise sage mentor here.
Thank you.
yeah, I love it. In A Feast for Crows, Cersei chapter, she's irritated that Littlefinger's only message since he left King's Landing is to ask for some tapestries. And everyone back then assumed that they were Targaryen tapestries and that he was preparing to switch sides for the inevitable Daenerys invasion. But this specific theory now has been debunked because the tapestries were hunting tapestries of Robert's to bribe Nestor Royce. So
How would that make any sense anyway? Why would Cersei be like, yeah, go ahead, here, have these Targaryen things?
That's the other thing, but I have to admit I never thought about it. But now what this little incident in my eyes shows us is that Littlefinger is not really into either Dany or Aegon, Fagan, whatever, and has his eyes squarely on Westeros. I don't think he's anticipating that much any Targaryen invasion. That's just a feeling I get from this chapter. I'm not sure whether I'm on the right track here, but it was just what I am getting at. And driving up the food prices, which is a thing he does, seems to be just the thing he does, you know, because it is expedient and he can make a good dime and gain some leverage here, but not part of a greater picture. He seems to be waiting what's happening on the sidelines.
That makes sense to me. I'll admit that I, at this point, am probably fairly confused as to who knows what about whom. What's going on overseas, you know, what's happening down south. How widely publicized is it at this point that the Fagan has landed?
That's a good question. We don't know where in the Winds of Winter Elaine is.
Right.
It might be before Arianne, in which case almost no one knows.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard because we're talking about events in two books that have been published, Feast and Dance, one of which is very old. We're talking about random chapters selected with no spatio, you know, temporal context from a book that hasn't come out yet. And all of this is sort of confusingly juxtaposed against the relative knowledge that people have of Daenerys in Game of Thrones, which is generally much more than the characters have in the books, but it, you know, it all kind of blends together over the years, and I find it difficult to kind of peel it all apart. But it does, it seems to me like, you know, given I do think it's fair to believe that Littlefinger and Varys are working at cross purposes, and to the extent that Varys is the backer of both of the Targaryen siblings in one way or the other, regardless of which one he's more serious about backing, it doesn't make sense for Littlefinger to side with either of them.
Not really, no.
Yeah.
I think that's also true for the show, by the way. It seems like Littlefinger, also in the show, is very squarely in the Westeros corner of events.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. Yeah, for sure.
About other stuff, I had made some notes when I read through the chapter, and I think one of the major things to take away is the incident with Sir Shedrick the Wild Mouse, mm-hmm. which, of course, Brienne encountered first in Feast for Crows, and it seems like that guy is trying to abduct Sansa in the near future.
Yeah, and I love that kind of story where this guy is just this little this ticking time bomb that hasn't gone off. You know, and they he keeps popping up, and there'll be like a one line or two line reference to him, and then, you know, we know what we know, but the other characters have no idea. I love that.
Yeah, he's also mirroring this snail knight guy from the Mystery Knight.
Yep,
I forgot his name, but he kind of seems like the same person, you know, the same kind of person.
I like that. You know, these more mercenary knights, I think, are appealing characters. You know, they're just sort of these roguish.
The Hatch Knights.
Yeah. It's just a cool character class, as it were. You know, the thing I always think about when I think about this, hopefully this isn't ruining anything for anyone who hasn't seen The Sopranos, but there's a character in The Sopranos who you find out is an FBI informant. And it's like three or four seasons later that anything comes of it. And I fucking loved that. I thought that was so smart. And the way that David Chase, the creator of the show, relied upon the fact that this was kind of a tertiary character and we had all this other stuff going on to make the audience, to lull the audience into this false sense of security, just as the characters had a false sense of security, you know, having no idea that that was going on. You know, I like any story that's willing to play the long game like that and trust you to sort of keep up and rely on your natural, the natural wavering of your attention to other more pressing matters to kind of once again take you by surprise with the seeds that they planted long ago. I love that stuff. So,
yeah, me too. This is what makes it so interesting to go through these chapters.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I would share your take on it, basically, that there isn't that much there. I really have some very disconnected notes that just the Royces are the Starks of the Vale. They're just as stupid and just as honorable. You know, giving Harry the heir to Littlefinger is just so incredibly stupid, but it is also something that Eddard would do. Because I promised it, and I have to keep my word.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, another interesting thing is that even Robert Arryn is smart enough to see a threat if there is one. Because he knows that someone is out there to kill him, but he can't do anything about it. It's really a tragic position the little boy is in.
Yeah, that is depressing. He's completely aware that he's superfluous to everyone's needs.
And that he's as good as dead.
Yeah, that's a tough row to hoe, for sure. And, yeah, you know, I think there's a temptation to see him as kind of feeble-minded when he's not. He's just been sort of ruined by his life of pampering. And so the fact that he's intuitive enough to pick up on the fact that he's dead meat, like there's something like really kind of grimly, you know, it's like a black comedy, this poor kid marching to his death, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, was there anything else to tackle in there? Or?
After the prominent introduction that Miranda Royce got back in A Feast for Crows, she does surprisingly little in this chapter.
Yeah, I guess there's still plenty of time, because, as you know, we have no idea how many Elaine chapters there'll be.
Yeah, that's weird.
But, she did get a big, big entrance. And I wonder how things... You know, there's a lot of questions like that in terms of... just where will the narrative weight fall on the new characters? You know, even someone as comparatively major as Euron Crow's Eye, I think there's a lot of question as to, you know, it seems like you give this character this huge introduction. He's playing into various characters' visions. He's going to be some kind of main antagonist maybe for the final volumes. But if so, that's like you're introducing a major antagonist pretty late in the game. Same with Fagon, you know?
Yes.
So it still makes me very curious about lesser characters who also get like a big entrance like Miranda Royce.
There is no way that we don't lose really a lot of them in The Winds of Winter. And of course, what is it called? A Dream of Spring.
Yeah.
Because there is no other way to wrap this up. Many of them have to go. And I mean, Victarion, of course, is dead meat. I would argue Barristan Selmy is dead meat in the middle run of events. And there are several others. I mean, many of those Vale characters are not long for the world.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. There will be a concentration on some main characters, which is incidentally something that the show already does. You can see what is happening when you only have a limited roster of characters in the show, which is something I definitely want to talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But just to wrap this up, Maya Stone seemed superfluous in the chapter, and Lynn Corbray is the Dark Star of the Vale. But that is about all that I got out of it.
I think you got the final word on that. I agree. Yeah.
Okay, there was a surprisingly short take on Elaine.
Well, there's not a whole lot to say, you know? I mean, I'm sure we could drum up some preposterous theory that she's actually Dario Naharis, but...
She's Rhaegar.
Yes, come again. That's why she's dyeing her hair.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's kind of like the theory about how, after a certain point, Paul McCartney is no longer Paul McCartney. He's Billy Shears, the guy that they hired to replace Paul McCartney when Paul McCartney died in a car accident. Like, after the chapter titles turned from Sansa to Elaine, she's no longer Sansa. Sansa was, in fact, tossed out the moon door by Lysa Arryn. It's now Rhaegar. He snuck in. It's part of Littlefinger's big plan. That's why he asked for the Targaryen tapestries.
And you know what? That makes sense in the context of the series, too. Because he's in cahoot with the Boltons, who exchanged Mance Rayder, who, of course, is also Rhaegar, and gave him together with... and so he could take Mance slash Rhaegar slash Sansa from Winterfell to the Eyrie. This plan is great.
I think so. And, you know, before people complain about the logistics... of how Rhaegar traveled from one place to the other, from being Mance Rayder to being Elaine so quickly, he found in the vaults below Winterfell the time machine that the show version of Littlefinger uses to travel back and forth.
Always thought he teleports.
Yeah, because that's what's keeping Winterfell so warm. It's not dragon eggs. It's a rupture in the space-time continuum that he's now accessing.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I think we've got this figured out. I think it's pretty sound. But look for my 6-part YouTube series on this. I think it'll answer a lot of questions for everybody.
I think we just lost at least 200 listeners last year.
Well, then we should talk about the enormously popular television series to win them back, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, when we're recording this, 2 episodes of Season 5 of Game of Thrones are available for everybody to watch legally, which I feel like we should specify, because I've seen 4 perfectly legally because they were given to me by the network, and lots of people have seen 4 because... some other asshole who got them from the network decided to rip them to the internet, which means that people like me probably won't be getting them from the network in the future. Which makes my life a little difficult. But, yeah, so we've now seen episode 2 as of last night. Officially.
Yeah.
So what have you been thinking, Stefan?
I think it started really well.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't have to say that much, because season 4 also started really well, and it went crest of fuck in at least some parts of it. But as for now, it really got off to a pretty great start, especially the first episode. I thought the second was a little bit weaker because of pacing issues, but the first one at least was a real blow.
See, I'd say the opposite. To me, the first episode was a little more herky-jerky than the second episode. But when you go back and you look at the season premieres for all 5 seasons, you know, I think season 1's a standout simply because it's the very first episode. And I think season 4's premiere, Two Swords, I think that's actually a very good episode, objectively. But for the most part, they have so much, like, just introducing people to do. In the first 2 episodes now, it takes them 2 episodes to get to everybody. And I don't think that if they still gotten it, I don't think they've gotten to everybody yet.
The Boltons. The Boltons are missing.
Yeah.
Boltons are missing.
So, yeah, I don't. They're generally not as. The early episodes to me are never as strong as it gets. Well, I mean, as soon as episode 3 or episode 4, and then certainly towards the end of the season, generally speaking. But I've enjoyed it. This probably won't come as a surprise to people, but I don't have any kind of a priori problem with the changes that they've made to the storylines, which have been pretty big, and maybe even bigger than I expected or anticipated.
Yes, absolutely. I was a little bit dumbstruck at first, especially in episode one. I really missed when I first watched it that Littlefinger is going north. I entirely missed it. I just thought he was now moving around the whale because there was this Elaine chapter lying around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I totally missed that one. But it makes sense. We don't have Jane Poole, and if they would pull her out now, everyone would be, who the fuck is this? And it just wouldn't work that way.
Yeah... I have to be circumspect here in talking about this, I suppose. But
I don't know for sure, but Sansa is going to marry Ramsay. There is no other reason for this to go on.
Let's say that happens. Then I think that's a fairly similar situation to what's happening in Dorne, with Alaria taking the place of Arianne. I think it's fairly similar on a slightly larger level with sending Jaime into Dorne to presumably lock horns with somebody who hates the Lannisters, then sending him into the Riverlands and doing it.
What you're doing is
you're consolidating things rather than cutting things outright.
This is actually what I meant when I said earlier that the show doesn't have that much choices. I'm currently in an argument on the Tower of the Hand because I said that Mace Tyrell is going to go to Braavos.
Mm-hmm.
And no, this isn't in the episode per se, but there is really not that much choice. I mean, Cersei is making him the Master of Coin, and we don't have Harry Swift. So given that the Iron Bank is a major player here, we have to get some characters involved in Braavos or else this story thread withers on the vine. So the only one who can be sent there who has at least some recognition to his name is Mace Tyrell. And the same is true for marrying someone to Ramsay. The only character we have that we care about, and we need to care about her, or else this will be another torture fest, is Sansa. There is simply no other way to do this. And this is quite clever to actually recognize from the show creators and make into the best possible story.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that book fans, you know, I don't want to sit and turn this into a lecture, you know, and sit and lecture book fans, of which I am one, you know, the whole time, because whatever, you all know how we feel about this kind of thing. But When you are a hardcore fan of these books, you can attach yourselves to minor characters in a way that exaggerates their actual narrative importance and the actual emotional pull that they exert, almost like a force of gravity. You know, like the bigger, the more massive the body is floating around out there in space, like the greater gravitational pull it exerts, right? If I'm remembering this correctly. I hope I am, because I have a 4-year-old who's interested in astronomy. But, you know, you may feel very, very strongly about Jane Poole, but even within the book, she's a minor character. And good for you that you're able to form this empathy with a person without having them narrate chapters for you. That's actually great. And that's a wonderful thing about these books. It allows us to do that. But when you're talking about a 10-episode, 10-hour narrative economy, there's just no room for all of a sudden, like, making you care about this new character that they're kind of shoving in. It always makes sense to hand important narrative tasks to characters who've already been established, with whom you've already connected, and give that to them to do. You know, I miss, all things considered, I actually miss the book's version of Alaria more than I miss Arianne, because Alaria is the rare character who's like, you know what, fuck this, enough of this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of killing people. It doesn't do anything. That's such a rare perspective, and it's a shame that we lose that. More to me than it's a shame that we lose, you know, Arianne, you know, the sort of rebel seductress or whatever, but boy, hear about it for that. But you know, but it makes sense for them to consolidate those characters instead of whipping up a new one. To me, it does.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is also the reason why Mans Raider is dead. There is no glamour going on, and he didn't switch places with Torment. For Christ's sake, Torment got much more screen time than Mans did.
Yeah.
Of course they are going to keep Torment. Torment is also the more interesting character of the two.
Yeah, I kind of think he is. Yeah,
absolutely he is. There is simply no, as not in the books, but in the show. There is simply no reason to keep Mans around, especially since I still regard Hinz, or Heinz, I don't know how you pronounce him, as kind of a miscasting for the role. But that's my personal thing. He's a good actor, but I don't think he's fitting the role.
He's not the Torment, I mean, he's certainly not the Torment of the books. You know, he's much more of a grim kind of character. It was almost weird to hear him tell the story about fucking the bear in the battle episode last season. Like, it seemed so out of character for him, you know?
Yeah, I don't mean Torment. I don't like Mans Raiders.
Heinz. Yeah. Okay, I thought... I got completely confused. I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, that's another... You know, they made him kind of a more... He's not the sort of trickster god that he is in the book, you know?
Absolutely not, no. Did you know that they originally wanted to cast Dominic West?
I did know that.
Yeah,
yes.
He would have been...
Yep. I mean, I like that actor. He's very good in Tinker Tailor... he's got a very minor role in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. What am I talking about? He looks great in it, though. I think he worked in this final episode. I think he struck me as someone who, like, that's the conclusion he'd come to, all right, yep.
Yeah, that scene was great.
Yeah.
The dialogue, I think this was these first two episodes, Nine, and I really hope this constitutes a trend, are the first episodes in which Jon Snow is becoming a really great character.
Yes. Yeah.
And the same
is also
true for Daenerys. But Daenerys had her great epic moments, and Jon was lacking even those.
Yeah.
But now they are both becoming really interesting characters in their own right. And that scene with Mans Raider was really the starting shot for this.
Yeah, I talk about this a bit in my review of last night's episode for Rolling Stone. The cool thing about Jon at this point is that basically alone among the major characters, he's earned his position of leadership rather than seizing it or having it awarded to him by decree. And how did he earn it? I mean, it's like Sam said, he learned it through bravery. He earned it through bravery. He earned it through loyalty. He earned it through cleverness and intelligence, and ultimately kindness, because he's a person who is able to relate to all sides of this conflict in a way that Alistair Thorne can't. And I'll give this to Alistair Thorne. His speech after John is nominated by Sam, where he criticizes John, is a lot more reasonable than I thought it was going to be. Like, he did not insult him the way Jenna Slint would. I mean, he's not a fan, obviously, but he didn't say anything that's like he didn't say anything unreasonable, which I was actually kind of impressed by. But anyway,
yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
This is also something that I have written in my review about the situation of this election. Is slightly different than in the books, but it has some ripple effects on the details, you know, because Jon's decision to reject the title of Jon Stark isn't such a suicide mission as in the books, where it is clear that Jenna Slint is going to win the election and then going to kill him.
Right.
It is clear in the show that Alistair Thorne will win, but Thorne as Lord Commander is, as I have written, like if you would be for all eternity subjected to the Drill Commander of Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
It's unpleasant, but it's not like he's that bad a commander. You know,
he
just eats your guts.
Yeah.
And that's a difference right there.
Yeah.
And I think I like it.
I like it too. I mean, I like any time that people who are at odds kind of acknowledge that the other person has a valid point of view or has valid contributions to make. And, you know, and Thorne says, I can't disagree with anything that was just said. He can't. So he doesn't. I actually really respected that. You know, and then, you know, ultimately, you know, in the end, John wins and it's great. And I just like seeing him smile when he won, you know? Like, is he won because people like him? People believe in him. He deserved it. That's why he won. And he was able to finally kind of feel good about himself in a way that it's not like he feels good about himself because Ned said something nice, or because Benjen did something nice, or because Mormont did something nice, or because Stannis did something nice. You know, his peers said, you know, you're a good dude, man. We like you. We're voting for you. We respect you. You can lead us. That's why he felt good. That's really cool.
Absolutely. As a side note, if any one of our listeners are playing the Telltale game series, it's also interesting how they manage to get the nuances of the show right, because they are modeling the games on the show and not on the books, and they also get those nuances in difference between the characters, which is quite nice.
That is cool. I would like to play that game. People have been asking, like, will we do an episode on those? I would like to play that game. My problem is I always run out of room on my iPhone, because it turns out you can't have games like that and the entire recording discography of King Crimson on your iPhone at the same time. They basically just won't fit. So I have to set priorities, and it's always the rock and roll for me, baby. But
you would play this game on your iPhone?
Well, where else are you supposed to play it?
I don't know. A computer? A console?
Isn't this the thing? What game is this? Maybe I'm talking about a different game. Is this the thing where there's, like, chapters and it's tied in with the show and you're some house in the north named after a
tree? Yeah, exactly. But I mean, this is an adventure game. I can't imagine.
Oh, you can play this on your computer?
Yes, of course.
Well, how the hell do I know, man? I'm a grown-up. I don't play video games.
We are losing listeners today.
I'm kidding.
Oh, man.
I'm a grown-up. I read about dragons. I don't play video games. Video games are for losers.
Yeah, exactly.
Now back to my job where I write about Gotham and Daredevil for money.
Yeah, but this is yet another example of how limited their options are. I mean, in the books, there is a host of officers and authority figures and the like, and Martin killed a lot of them off in for 3 books, but there are still many left.
Yeah.
In the show, there is no one left. We have Janice Lind, who is an idiot, and he was discredited in the battle, and I like how Sam dresses him down. And then we have Alyssa Thorne, and that's it, really. The only other guy we get is Melisar, and he's introduced in 1 minute and discarded the next.
Yeah.
So it's really a 2-man contest, and that's the way it plays out, and that's well done, I think.
Now, here's a question for you. I assumed, on a very related note, I assumed that by the same token, rather than introducing the shave paint and, you know, create this entire idea of this faction within the former Great Masters, who are now very, very hardcore devotees of Dany, that they were going to use the slave character, Missandor, to play that role, where he'd be like the, you know, he'd be the extremist Daenerys supporter, who ultimately would come to see that she wasn't extreme enough on her own behalf, and work to undermine her the way that presumably the shame paint is doing in the books, although we don't know for sure. But they killed him.
Yes.
That kind of took me by surprise. I don't know.
Yes and no. I have to admit, I didn't think about him enough to decide either way. Mm-hmm. before he was killed.
My point was that rather than introducing a new faction, they would just go to something slightly easier to convey in a short amount of time, which is the slave population or the ex-slave population, you know.
Oh, they also have someone in her council doing that. It is just another instance where they don't use a specific role, where they don't cast a double, so to speak,
right?
Because Dario is filling in that spot. In the books, he is constantly away, either in her bed or on reconnaissance mission, so he can't weigh in on the council. But here in the show, he's on the council, so why do I need 2 guys saying the same thing?
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
And that's why they can kill him, and killing him was important because we got this, the law is the law. It was Judge Dredd Targaryen speaking here, I guess.
Yeah, what was I got a Vitri Vitri Issa or something, whatever it is in High Valyrian that she says. That's a pretty cool line. The law is the law. The whole thing, I thought it was an effective scene.
Very much so.
Makes a point, and I should be quiet at that point. I should be quiet at this point.
What I really like is the moral dilemma that it presents for Dany, and if they can keep this kind of story up, her arc in this season will be one of the best ever.
Yep.
I don't know whether or not they will be able to keep it up, because that's difficult, but it is really well done up to this point.
I think this is the season where they can make explicit a lot of the stuff about her that's been implicit before, the white savior stuff and the difficulty of... We talk about her storyline over and over and over and again within the books. We've had years to do it, and still get no closer to coming up with the right answer, because there isn't one. That's good. That makes for good television if you can pull that off, you know, and daring television, because people want a right answer, you know.
Yes.
So for them to just sort of dig into her intractable dilemma.
There are so many levels to her storyline in those two episodes alone.
Yeah.
Because when you just look at how this execution scene is filmed, as she is looking away, you know, and this mirrors so much of the first execution we get in a whole series with Bran and stuff. Mm-hmm. I've also written this in my review, because it is, Father notices that she looks away, you know, she can't look, she can't swing the sword herself, she can't even give the damn order. Dario is doing the same thing as Mosendor, that he is interpreting what she wants. He's just better at this than he is.
Yeah.
But she is not able to do this, to face the realities of ruling, at least not yet.
Yep. Wow. Go ahead.
Yeah, there is so much to this scene, just in the acting and in how it is filmed, you know, in what the camera focuses on. It is his unbelieving and terrified look on his face, and then he fades into the background, and we get her really, how do you say this? She is really trying not to look at him, and then Dario is ending it. And then you get this moment of silence, and she's evacuated. She can't really walk on her own. She's just walking like in a dream kind of state.
Yeah.
And this is interesting. And then the last scene of the episode was such a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah.
When Drogon lands on the pyramid, and then she tries to touch him, but Drogon pulls his head back and then flies away. Because we have talked about this over and over again in the books, just how Drogon and Dario are representing the blooded, fire and blood type of her personality.
Mm-hmm.
And now this fire and blood type is flying away, and what remains is the law is the law. And she will get into problems with it, and I think the moment when she realizes it, Drogon will be back in episode 9 or 10, I guess 10. But this is so well set up.
Yep.
It is really damn good television right here.
And you make a great point about that she's not the woman who passes the sentence does not swing the sword. I mean, you can't...
She hasn't even passed the sentence.
Well, I mean, she says the penalty is death. And there he is.
Yes,
but she doesn't actively... You're right. She, you know, once he says... Like, she doesn't... She just talks about
it. She shirks responsibility.
Vague general terms. She doesn't say, I condemn you to die for, you know, all the kinds of things that Ned did. And, you know, I think given John's storyline during this segment of his story and certain upcoming events, I think there's a pretty direct contrast there to be made.
Yeah.
And with Ned and with Rob and with Theon and with...
Yes,
you know.
They are going to mirror their own storylines, and
yep.
this is really just great. And obviously there is a great degree of planning and understanding of the plots and characters involved here, because else you couldn't pull this off. And they pull it off.
And even in this episode, there's a contrast between her and Prince Doran and her and Cersei, and, you know, all this stuff is baked into the original, obviously. But that's what makes it a good television show, is the richness of it. You know, it's so dense. and you can pull it apart as a on a narrative level and talk about the characters and the plot points. And unfortunately, a lot of the times, that's all you have room to do if you're writing a review, particularly if you have a tight word count from your editor. But you can pick at the stuff and pull it apart and reconfigure it in different ways for a long, long time and not run out of stuff to say.
Absolutely. So let's slowly move away from John and Danny, Sansa and Littlefinger. What do we have? Oh, Arya and Jaqen H'ghar and Hagar.
My one problem with this is that, you know, when it became clear that they were going to do the Tyler Durden bit and not let her in at first, I'm not sure what the reversal was. Like, why did they change their mind when they changed their mind?
Exactly my problem.
Yeah.
I have no clue what the test was.
Right. Maybe there wasn't a test. In the end, though, it probably won't matter. It's a minor thing compared to all the cool shit that we will presumably get to see with the Faceless Men and the House of Black and White. And Arya in general. So it's a quibble. It's not. I'm not crumpling up the episode and tossing it away because of that.
No, of course not. It was just a minor thing.
Yeah.
But what do you think about Jaqen H'ghar? I mean, it was one of the worst guarded secrets that he would be back, and you could count two and two together to figure out what role he would be in.
Well, it's the same consolidating principle that we had, you know, with Littlefinger and Sansa going north, or Jaime going south, or Larya taking the place of Arianne. You know, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, to me as well. I think one big problem in the general discussion one could encounter is that Jaqen H'ghar is one of those figures that is surrounded by so many conspiracy theories that it becomes hard to count. And when you get right down to it, it really doesn't matter at all what he does and where he is.
Yep.
Whether he's in Old Town or whether he is in Braavos, who cares?
Yep.
Yeah, you know, it just doesn't matter. He's too inconsequential by now.
Inconsequential how?
Yeah, I mean, he's... The main role that Jaqen H'ghar had was to be one of Arya's mentors in A Clash of Kings.
Right.
And kind of a temptation for her to reject. Everything else is an afterthought. I mean, his story in A Feast for Crows is a really minor appearance you could miss easily in two chapters.
That's
so far.
I guess that's true, but I mean, I think Jaqen, I think, is a rare case where the conspiracy theory at least makes emotional sense to me, in that he's very cool, you know.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
The cool,
but he's
super assassin who can shapeshift and
yes. My point is, it doesn't matter where he is cool. He can
right.
be cool.
He's still
going to
be cool wherever he is.
He's cool in Old Town,
yep.
And the show makes it perfectly clear that he isn't a figure of overall importance to the narrative. It doesn't matter that much where he is or what he does. The main point is that he is cool and relatable, and he's the badass assassin, you know, and doing
gotcha.
Badass assassin stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yep.
Other than that, I like the ambience and look of Braavos, but we don't see that much yet.
Yeah, I liked it a lot, too. I watched the episode again last night as it aired live with my mom, and just thought, wow, this is I'm glad we're here. I'm glad we're seeing Braavos. It's a cool world to get plopped into. I don't know. What else is there? Brienne?
Brienne, yeah. I mean, everything makes sense.
Yeah, Brienne is a character. I'd say the two characters, as much as I actually like them, particularly in terms of the performances on the show, where the changes bother me the most are Brienne and Stannis.
Okay.
Brienne, yeah, from the moment she killed those first Stark soldiers in anger, I just always felt that she was too angry a character. And in a way that didn't necessarily make sense with someone who had no combat experience. The anger does, but like her skill at employing it to kill people never quite made sense to me. And but now it makes sense insofar as the Brienne of the show may be like a much angrier, scarier person than the Brienne. Scarier is a good word for it. Than the Brienne of the books. But she's also much more unlucky and had much more shit dumped on her. Like, both Stark kids rejected her.
I like that.
I like it too. Now it works for me. You know, now it works for me. I like it too. Took me a while, but as of this episode, I'm like, okay, I get it. I get it. I get how this character works on the show.
Yeah, Brienne is just a juggernaut. I mean, she's one of the best fighters around. She absolutely is not in the books there. She's more coming from the Dunk the Tall school of fighting.
Yeah.
But in the show, she is just really, really good and kills everyone who gets in her path. And I think that works well enough. And I think the direction where she's going is much more interesting than roaming the Riverlands. So, yes, I'm on board with it.
Well, you know, I mean, it depends on how you define interesting, I guess. I think that the thing that she and Stannis and Larya have in common, as the characters where I regret the changes the most, is that they were all kind of just slightly off-model from what you expect from those kinds of characters.
Yes.
Generally. You know, like, Larya, you expect to be screaming for vengeance, and she's not. Stannis, you expect to be like, I am the king, and I'll do da-da-da. And, like, he seems, like, basically unhappy with it in the books. That's what's cool about him. That, like, he wants to be king because, in his mind, he is the king. Like, he has no choice.
Yes,
you know,
but
it's not that he's reluctant, necessarily. It's just that he's not like, ooh, I can't wait to be king. He's like, I already am king. You know,
yes,
people
absolutely.
Just have to get with the fucking program. If I have to deal with it, so do all of you assholes. That's fun. And with Brienne, you know, I like that she's, you know, basically born into a body and a mindset that makes her fit for this one thing. But she's never been able to do it until now. And just kind of experiencing that with her, I appreciated. Those are why those differences bother me a lot more than anything else. But anyway.
I am totally on board with that they are things I like in the books. I really like them a lot, which I guess sets me apart with a lot of people. I'm not complaining that Brienne roaming the Riverlands in A Feast for Crows is boring or anything. It was on the first read, but I've gotten around since. No, that's not my problem. I think the changes work for the show. And I don't think that either Jaime or Brienne would have worked well roaming the Riverlands and going to the Siege of Riverrun and stuff. It would just not have fit into the pace of the other events.
I agree with you, yeah. It has to be, has to move a little more crisply.
Yes, it just has to. And so many of those details in the books are heavily reliant on internal monologue, especially, of course, in Brienne's case. And you don't want to see her constantly whining to Pod because he's the only one she could whine at. And it doesn't make for good television. Simple as that.
Yeah, agreed.
So what about Jaime and his quest to Dorne?
You know, there's not much to say yet because we haven't seen it. I think it makes sense for him to decide that that's going to be his redemption arc. He's going to go and rescue their daughter and maybe earn himself back into Cersei's good graces, or maybe just prove that he's still good for something, that he actually can protect the people he cares about. And just on the level of television, you get to see him looking like a cool, handsome guy in a leather jacket, roaming around with Bronn cracking wise and killing people and being handsome and rugged. You know, I'm totally all for that.
Yes, absolutely. It's Han Solo and Chewbacca.
yes, thank you. Oh, man, thank you. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
But, I mean, I don't know how it will play out, but the two of them are about the most not... how do you say? They are not secretive in any way. You know, I mean, they could take some hoods over their heads, but that wouldn't make them more... and inconspicuous.
Yeah, you can't send like, you know, one of, you know, there's maybe half a dozen people in all of Westeros that can be considered famous.
Yes, but Jaime,
you know, in this medieval society, and Jaime was one of them before he had a hand made of solid or made of not
yeah.
solid gold, made of gold. You know, like,
and Bronn also can't pass as a Dornish man.
No, he can't. Well, you know, what are you going to do? You know, is this sort of, you know, obviously it's a replacement for Jaime's quest in the Riverlands, but is it also kind of a replacement for the Quentin quest?
And perhaps...
I mean, not on a plot level, but just sort of on an emotional level. Like,
I don't think so.
You know, it's a guy trying to do something for his family.
No, not at all. It can't work on an emotional level, because Quentin's quest on an emotional level is the perfect deconstruction of the hero's journey.
Quest. Yeah, yeah.
And Jamie, no. He can't do that.
That's fair. Okay. Maybe I'm overreaching.
I think it's just an entirely new storyline, which will play out mostly as a comedy and adventure story. But I could be wrong, of course.
Yeah. I don't... just as a wild guess, I don't think Bronn's going to make it.
Okay.
That's. I have no idea where that's coming from. That's just my instinct. There was something else I wanted to say about this. The other thing I wanted to say about Jaime and the whole Dornish storyline is just that his relationship with Bronn itself is also an act of sort of narrative substitution on the part of the show. You know, in the books, Bronn's role in Jaime's retraining was played by Ilan Payne. Now, I think the show probably was forced to drop that element of it because the actor, an awesome, awesome guitar player from Dr. Feelgood, who plays Ilan Payne, Vilko Johnson, got, you know, terminally sick, which is awful. But they may have done it anyway, again, just to keep the emphasis on characters with whom we have this kind of connection. And it gives them an opportunity to have two funny, fairly dashing characters hang out together a lot, which I support, again. And the same principle is in play with Tyrion and Varys. They're just fun people who get to hang out together, and I like that.
Yeah, you know, I really prophesized that Varys would remain in Pentos, but I was wrong on that. Mm-hmm. I had expected him to leave Tyrion much earlier than he seems to do now. I mean, they are going to Valantis, and Valantis is the place where they have to meet Jorah Mormont, because there is really no other place they could do this. So parting is warranted. But they make for a good combination, yes. And it seems like they're also cutting short the whining and drinking part of the books, which pissed so many people off. Penny is almost certainly cut out. The whole Aegon storyline seems to go. So there is a very streamlined version of Tyrion's journey to be expected.
Yeah, I miss some of those characters too. I'll miss Penny. I think that could have been really cool if they do cut her. I miss Quentin, obviously, like I said. Aegon, you know, I just don't know whether cutting him is a good idea or not, because we don't know exactly how that'll play out. It seems like he's an awfully big deal. Even though he's fake, he's still a big deal.
Yes.
But, you know, they're cutting that. At the same time, though, they're obviously not cutting out what's going to happen with Grayscale. They've made a pretty big deal about that. Even if it's only for some big Bridge of Dream scene coming down the line to establish that.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, even if they don't go any further than that. You know, it's just... We're at the stage where a lot of this is guesswork and trying to determine the relative, you know, even people like us who are not saying, like, oh, they changed it from the books, how dare they? You know, naturally, we compare and contrast the books to the show. And it's getting to the point where the books have not finished. You know, these are like unfinished sentences in a way. Incomplete sentences, and it's just, you can guess why the show is making the decisions it's making. What they're trying to emphasize relative to the books, where they're trying to save space, where they're trying to grow things, but it's inconclusive because the books have yet to conclude.
Yes, but it's fun to speculate either way.
I agree. The books may have yet to conclude, but I think we're about to conclude. Unless you can think of anything else you wanted to add.
How could I add something to an end sentence so good?
I know. That's why they pay me the big bucks. I am a craftsman of scintillating prose. I write Valyrian sentences, is what I do.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Spells woven in. Human sacrifices.
All that.
Yeah. So, well, thanks, everybody, as always, for tuning in to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. It's great to be back. And we have grand plans, like I always say. It's just a question of real life intervening. I've been very, very busy. It's a very busy television season, as you all know, with Game of Thrones coming back, Mad Men's final season, Daredevil's first season, Gotham I'm covering The Americans, which is great, which everybody should be watching. It's as good as anything on television at this point. I did Better Call Saul. I'm doing random other things. And much more importantly than that, Stefan has an even more high-profile assignment. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I have at least someone sharing my high-profile assignment, even taking the major workload out of it, because I had witnessed the birth of my second child, which is a girl. She's now 5 weeks old. And as you can imagine, it's a pain in the ass in terms of work and sleep and all the stuff involved. Mm-hmm. But at least we buffed our nerd credentials because her name is Liana. So.
Oh, that's so great.
And if you check out my blog, you can even see a picture of her in a Stark jacket. So there is very cute stuff ahead. So I really hope that the workload will decrease a bit, not for you, for professional reasons, but perhaps we will be able to brave the time zones a little bit more coherently in the next time.
Yeah, but either way, I mean, you know, people always ask, and I feel bad about spending as much time as I have to do answering questions. Like, hopefully, maybe it's hard, and even talking about it in the podcast. But rest assured, we love doing the podcast. We love talking to each other about this stuff. Like, it's always under consideration. We're always talking behind the scenes, even if you don't hear from us. Like, I promise we both really like doing this podcast, and we're going to keep it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening, guys.
We swear it by ice and fire. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.